Want to welcome you all to this important forum this afternoon at USIP. Before I say anything else, we have a peculiar sound system that reacts very badly to cell phones that are switched on. So even if the cell phone doesn't ring, if it's switched on, it will interfere with the sound system. So please, anybody with a cell phone, please switch it off. The press is filled with stories of Shia-Sunni hatred and conflict in Iraq. Beyond Iraq, there's an effort by predominantly Shia Iran to assert itself in the Middle East. Predominantly Sunni countries like Jordan and Saudi Arabia feel threatened and are pushing back. Hatred of Israel by other states in the region may be at an all-time high. And beyond Israel, there are signs of growing anti-Jewish sentiment in many parts of the world. Christians are fleeing from Iraq and from the Palestinian territories, and most Christians in Lebanon are pushing back against pressure from Shia-dominated Hezbollah in that divided society. The picture is not a happy one. And yet, we all know of courageous members and leaders of all these religious communities who reach out across lines of religious division. USIP has supported the Alexandria process in Israel-Palestine. We've co-sponsored with the Arab Group for Christian-Muslim Dialogue, a workshop on teaching about the religious other in the Middle East. We've worked closely with the Sudan Interreligious Council. We supported the effort to create an Iraqi religious council. We have hosted delegations, religious delegations from Iran and Saudi Arabia. We sponsored research and are now publishing a book by Mohammed Abu Nimer on interfaith dialogue in the Middle East. And there are many other efforts underway by other organizations that USIP is not involved with. The purpose of this workshop is to explore both the tensions and conflicts, but also to illuminate the efforts to improve interfaith relations. Unfortunately, we have a panel of highly regarded experts to address these issues. And I'll introduce each speaker in turn. Rand Rahim Frankie, we're pleased to have currently as a senior fellow at USIP. She's the founder and executive director of the Iraq Foundation for more than a decade. She served as Iraq's representative to this country, and resulting from a grant from USIP, she's the co-author with Graham Fuller of a book entitled The Arab Shia, The Forgotten Muslims. So, Ren, would you start us off,
please? Yes. Thank you, David. I will speak about the relations between Sunni and Shia sects, specifically in Iraq, although I would like to start by setting the stage for the Shia-Sunni communities in the Middle East as a whole, and to cast something of a historical light on that. And then go back and focus on the current situation in Iraq, the period immediately before 2003, immediately after 2003, and how this has evolved over the last 4 years. But so it's sort of historically, I'm going to take a very macro look, and then go back and zero in on the Iraqi situation specifically. And I will only talk in specific terms about Iraq because although the issues of Sunni-Shia relations are very topical right now in other places, particularly in Lebanon, I think there are better experts on Lebanon to talk about that than I. The first point I'd like to make is that the split between Shiaism and Sunnism did not start as a doctrinal and theological split. It was initially and primarily a political difference over the succession to to the Prophet Muhammad first, and then to Abu Bakr and Ali, in other words, to the, what are called the Khulafa al-Rashideen. The view of those who came to be called Shia was that Imam Ali should have succeeded Muhammad immediately, and that he was in fact designated by the Prophet Muhammad as his successor. And the word Shia means partisans, and so their full name is Shi'at Ali. So initially we had a difference over politics, over succession, and over who should wield political power after the death of the Prophet Muhammad. Only subsequently, in the 9th and 10th centuries, did that difference crystallize into a doctrinal and theological difference. And I would like to suggest that not only was the origin of the split driven by politics, but that subsequent conflicts between Shia and Sunnis, including the conflict that we see in Iraq today, has nothing to do with differences in religious belief. It has everything to do with politics and power. Across the region, you have a number of countries, including Bahrain, Iraq, and possibly Lebanon, in which the Shia are a majority. You have a number of countries, including Saudi Arabia and Kuwait, in which the Shia are a sizable minority, meaning 10 to 20 or 25%. Historically, the Shia have always been the minority in Arab countries. And indeed, in all Muslim countries except for Iran. And those of you who know about the history of Shiaism know that Iran converted to Shiaism in the early 16th century, and the conversion was something of a forced conversion. The Shah at the time decided that he was going to become Shia, and therefore the entire population had to become Shia. But with that in mind, we should remember that the Sunnis, as a majority in the Muslim world, always had the upper hand. They always ruled the region, and the Shia were always the underdog. And when the modern states in the Middle East were formed, that situation unfortunately continued, even in countries such as Iraq and Bahrain, in which the Shia were manifestly a majority. So that Iraqi Shia now go back and say, for 8 decades, the Sunnis have ruled Iraq and we have had no share in the power structure of Iraq. And that has created a long-lasting, entrenched grievance amongst the Shia, which is now coming to the fore. And when I say now, I really mean in the last 2 decades only. That has been coming to the fore. It has been manifesting itself in Shia attempts at self-assertion, political visibility, and demands for a share of the political pie, sometimes with rather disastrous consequences, and almost always with a reaction from the local government of that country that has tried to suppress that Shia voice and has persecuted the Shia to a greater and lesser extent. Accompanying this underdog status of the Shia throughout Muslim history is a perception among the Sunni extremists, and I should single out particularly the Salafis here and the Wahhabis, although I know we shouldn't mix the two, but let us call them the very strict Wahhabis, of designating the Shia as not quite Muslims, in fact designating Shiaism as a whole as a heresy of Islam. And the common name that is used to refer to the Shia among this group of hardline Wahhabis is Ar-Rafida, in other words, the rejectionists, those who reject Al-Sunnah, which is mainstream Sunni Islam. And so within the vocabulary that has developed in Islam and Sunni Islam, there is a kind of a cloud cast upon the validity of the Islam of the Shia community. This has created a certain level of mutual suspicion between the Shia and the Sunnis in all the countries where they coexist. But the mutual suspicion has really rarely developed into open warfare, open conflict. And it sometimes amazes me to hear policymakers in Washington, when they talk about Iraq, referring to centuries of conflict between the Shia and the Sunnis in Iraq, and I wonder where they, what they're reading and where they get their information from, because actually incidents of open warfare between Shia and Sunnis in any particular country in the Middle East are extremely rare. I'd like to focus on Iraq now and take a few minutes to talk about the pre-2003 situation, and specifically, in order to sort of not get all over the place, I will take the 1990s as something of a defining decade in the developing relations between the Shia and the Sunnis. The 1991 uprising in Iraq, which took place round about March, immediately after the Gulf War, was really quite a massive event that was spearheaded and carried out by Iraqi Shia in southern Iraq against the regime of Saddam Hussein. The important issue here is that virtually all the governorates in southern Iraq, which are almost exclusively Shia, perhaps as much as 95% Shia, joined in that uprising against the regime. And of course, as we know, they were brutally repressed. There was a great exodus from Iraq after that uprising. But significantly, the uprising in the south was unable to attract any Sunnis from the Sunni governorates, neither from Baghdad nor any of the other Sunni governorates surrounding Baghdad. The Kurds, of course, had their own uprising in the same period. There wasn't very much contact between the two sections because of the geographic distance. But essentially, the uprising in 1991 stopped at the demarcation line where the Sunnis become predominant in society. And I think the cleavage between Shia and Sunnis in Iraq became far more marked as a result of this uprising. Suddenly the Shia felt themselves to be separate, to have a separate agenda, to have separate ambitions, to have separate needs. And the Sunnis, on the other hand, also became very conscious of the fact that they were the state, they were identified with the state, and that they had to make a choice in 1991 whether to go with this uprising to topple the regime, or whether they were in fact more secure with a Sunni regime than they would be supporting a Shia movement. So in a sense, we had a sort of foreshadowing in 1991 of the choices that were being made by the Shia and the Sunnis post-2003, that the choices were very stark in that period. And I think, although they were papered over later on, but I think they've sowed the seed for what happened later. Also in the decade of the 1990s, there was a campaign of faith that was announced by Saddam Hussein that emphasized religion in society, and it emphasized religion in society for the Sunnis as well as for the Shia, and that made people go back to religion, get back into their mosques, go back to their religious leaders. And so the religious sense in Iraq was strengthened in the 1990s, and that necessarily means sectarian sense. When we talk about religion, we're not just talking about Islam. They did not go to Unitarian mosques. The Sunnis went to Sunni mosques and the Shia went to Shia mosques. Another factor that we should talk about is that there is no doubt that Saddam Hussein in the 1990s, as a self-protection, a measure of self-protection, promoted fear in the Sunnis of the Shia threat and the renewed Iranian threat through the fifth columnist of the Shia. And so there was a new sort of fear within the Sunni community. And finally, I think there's a factor that people tend to forget about that was very important in the 1990s, and that's the economic factor. During the sanctions, it is quite clear that the Sunni community benefited from the economic structure that was set up by the Iraqi regime to counter the sanctions and to get around the sanctions, and the Shia community was unable to penetrate into that sort of economic structure that was built up, and their poverty increased, whereas the Sunni community was able to take some advantages. After 2003, in the immediate period, we unfortunately had policy decisions by the CPA and policy decisions and acts by the various communities that caused a deterioration in the relations. I again want to pause here and draw a sort of a general statement that I don't think that post 2003, that what has happened after 2003 and the situation that we see today between the sects was inevitable. An inevitable outcome of the collapse of Saddam Hussein. I think it was more an outcome of the policies of the governing authorities, be they the CPA or the Iraqi political leaders. So there was nothing sort of inexorable about where we are now. It was all man-made, if you want. The Shia, who had been out of power for at least 8 decades, had a sense of victory after 2003 and adopted a posture and a rhetoric of victory. And if you do that, what you're implying is that you have an adversary and that adversary has lost. If you have won, then the other side has lost. And so you get this kind of dichotomy where the Shia were very conscious of victory, speaking about victory, acting victorious, and the Sunnis, by implication, being the losers, having a strong sense of loss and a strong sense of being suddenly bereft of any power within this new order. The Shia were now what is called in Islam Ahlul Hilli wal Aqd. In other words, it was the Shia who made decisions about where the country was going. Ahlul Hilli wal Aqd means those who loosen and bind. In other words, those who have the ultimate authority to make decisions of the nation. Whereas pre-2003 it was the Sunnis, post-2003 it became the Shia. The CPA, one of the cardinal sins of the CPA, was that it saw Iraq in very simplistic reductionist terms. It divided Iraq into Sunnis, Shia, and Kurds. And from the very beginning, when the CPA appointed a governing council, they used that model of Iraqi society in order to build the political structure. Once they did that, of course, the political structure tended to entrench the differences rather than overcome them. So what you have is a system which becomes self-fulfilling, and that system entrenched the worst part of Iraqi society, the worst features of Iraqi society, and tended to weaken the other features of Iraqi society, which were more capable of transcending differences and working on a national level. So they sort of favored the sectarian divide and allowed it to deepen, as well as the ethnic divide. In doing so, the CPA was aided and abetted by many Iraqi political groups who relied for their political support on sectarianism, on their identity as representing a religious sect, not as their identity as representing, say, a political trend in society or a particular social group, but a sect. So there were many religious parties that supported this division of Iraqi politics, the model of Iraqi politics, into Shia, Sunnis, and Kurds. So in short, the political structure that was in place exacerbated sectarian differences rather than reconciled them. The post the initial period, in the last two or three years, we have had a number of problems that have again further embittered the relations between the two communities. The Sunnis, the sense of grievance of that the Sunnis now had translated itself into an insurgency or a resistance, and the Sunni leaders used that resistance or that insurgency as their insurance policy against the new order, so that the Sunnis were never willing outright to condemn the insurgency and to side fully and squarely within the new political order. The Shia, of course, felt that this was a betrayal of the new order and that the Sunnis were not cooperating totally. And so the distrust about where the Sunnis had their allegiance, whether they had their allegiance to the state or to the Sunnis, and the mutual Sunni distrust of the Shia, whether, again, they had allegiance to a national vision of Iraq or whether they owed loyalty only to their community, these mutual distrusts simply fed upon each other. Very quickly, how can we move forward here? I think the major way, the key issue right now is the Iraqi constitution, because it tends to embody many of the issues that divide the communities. And significantly, the Sunnis are eager for a revision of the constitution. The Shia and the Kurds, I should say, do not want to see a revision of the constitution. But if we are going to hope for any kind of reconciliation amongst the communities, the constitution has to be our primary target. And through that, a discussion of the constitution is going to be a major path towards reconciliation. Two other things that I would like to mention is the strengthening and the legitimacy of the judicial system in Iraq, which will have an enormous impact in restoring confidence and trust in the Sunnis and the Shia in the state, and strengthening the institutions of state as a whole, such as the army, the police, and creating truly national institutions out of those, so that there is something for the Sunnis and the Shia and everybody else to begin to identify with, because right now the sense of Iraqi, there is no state with which Iraqis can identify that is separate from their own sectarian identities. David, I'm sorry if I took too long.
It's fine. Thank you, Ren. That was a model of clarity for a very complex subject. For those of you who are standing in the back, I can see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 seats up here. There's another one over there. I think if you just don't feel like you're disrupting things, if you come and take the available seats, I hate to see you standing or sitting on the floor back there. Samuel Rizik will address the question of Christians in the Middle East. Samuel is currently a doctoral student at George Mason University. He was previously the executive director of the Forum for Development, Culture, and Dialogue based in Beirut. He's also very active in the Arab Group for Christian-Muslim Dialogue, which is probably the most important organization for Christian-Muslim dialogue in the Middle East. Samuel? Thank you, David. Thank you, Kumar and USIP for allowing me to be part of this certainly distinguished panel. Christians in the Middle East are in very different places, socially, demographically, economically, religiously, culturally, and certainly politically. For example, Christians in Lebanon comprise over one-third of the country's 4 million population and hold a relatively significant share of the political and social capital. Christians in Egypt comprise about 10% of the country's 75 million population and have a relatively meager share of the political and social capital. Christians in Palestine perhaps comprise about 3% or less in the West Bank and Gaza and have some voice in Palestinian political and cultural affairs. They represent about 2%, I think, of the population of Israel, with little or no voice in politics. In Iraq, they represent less than 1 million of the 30 million population and have little political significance, if any. The same can be said about Christians in Syria, perhaps. In Jordan, they represent about 3% of the 5 million population and enjoy a relatively significant profile in politics, economics, culture, and society. Despite these very different historic, cultural, and demographic places in which Christians find themselves, mainly in relation to a Muslim majority in the Arab Middle East, in recent years, many of these communities seem to find themselves preoccupied with very basic concerns, presence and survival. This is perhaps an indication that interfaith dialogue between Christians and Muslims in the Middle East has taken several steps backwards in relation to the significant gains it had made in the 1990s and into 2000. Why is this the case? I think it would be fair to say that the primary reason for this regression is politics. National politics, regional politics, and certainly international politics. And what I mean by politics here is a broad sense of the word. Economic politics, cultural politics, and last but certainly not least, religious politics, an aspect which I will further present here. It is this unholy mix of politics and religion that has, for the most part, impressed a heavy burden on interfaith relations in the Arab world. But it would seem that despite ongoing crises, like the Palestinian-Israeli conflict and poor economic development in the region, and you need only read the Arab Human Development Reports to realize the extent of the black hole in which Arab societies still live. So it is despite these ongoing crises, interfaith dialogue and cooperation, particularly at the civil society level, continue to grow steadily. One question that may arise here, of course, is whether interfaith cooperation, and particularly the involvement of Christians in interfaith action, has developed in spite of politics, or rather in response to politics, as a sober, rational, and legitimate way of managing religious diversity and promoting Christian-Muslim cooperation and understanding. What I intend to say here is the following. In the midst of many crises that have plagued the region during the time where interfaith dialogue activities have grown more popular, did interfaith action become more popular because it responded to the political and religious challenges and crises in the region? Or did these interfaith actions survive these crises and grow because they were oblivious to politics and other crises? The answer to this question is not as clear as one would have hoped. As such, I wish to highlight some events from the past couple of years of interfaith relations in just two countries, Egypt and Lebanon, those with which I am most familiar, and these questions could help guide a discussion. First, and very briefly, it is critical to ask the following question. Why do Christians get involved in civil society work in general, development, social services, human rights, and in interfaith dialogue activities in particular? For the most part, it's possible to identify three reasons, and there may be more, of course. The first is faith, and this can be seen as a Christian engagement with people of different faiths and belief systems from the very early days of Christianity with Jews, with Gentiles, and as an evangelistic religion, the purpose of this kind of engagement for many people could be conversion. In majority Christian communities, it is not uncommon to find this to be the outlook of Christians who see steadfast evangelism as an integral part of their faith. This, of course, becomes a little more tricky in communities where Christians are a minority.
A second reason is civic duty and responsibility towards the community. Perhaps for some along the lines of Jesus' words in the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 22, verse 21, give to Caesar what is Caesar's and to God what is God's. This conviction, for the most part, should place Christians, irrespective of demographics, firmly at the heart of the community in which they live, as equal citizens. While they may have duties to their community of faith, they also have duties to the broader community's national interests. One last reason could certainly be politics, and here mainly the politics of survival as a minority. This is especially critical for Christians in the Middle East. Engaging with their Muslim counterparts, keeping open channels of communication between the churches, the authorities, and official Islamic institutions is mainly seen as a politically expedient strategy for conflict prevention. The question thus becomes, has this worked? Have these official encounters at Christmas or at Eid translated into intercommunal understanding at times of trouble and tension? No matter how one looks at it, Christians believe that their faith entails some kind of social engagement with the other, with the neighbor, with the lesser of the brothers, and this engagement is just as strong where Christians are a minority as it is where Christians are a majority. For some Christians, this engagement at an extreme means taking every opportunity to preach the good news or to proselytize, while for others it is not a quid pro quo equation. They don't expect anything in return and see dialogue as a cast your bread upon the waters activity. But if you like to happen what you hear, they'll probably tell you more about their faith. Where then do these Christians mentioned above fit in contemporary interfaith dynamics in Egypt and Lebanon and in the Middle East in general? Over the past couple of years, there are particular incidents and dynamics that contributed to heightening the levels of tension in Christian-Muslim relations. And I speak here mainly of Egypt and Lebanon, but similar incidents can be found all around the region. The first is pure minority politics. The Coptic Orthodox Church in Egypt and its Pope publicly supported the current president's candidacy in mid-2005, but got nothing in return during the legislative election. In a game of high-stakes political poker between the government of Egypt and the still-banned Muslim Brotherhood, the Copts were told by the government that they were unelectable, and the entire community again had to deal with the 1970s and 80s slogans touting Islam as the solution. The resulting gains for the Muslim Brotherhood and subsequent parliamentary elections have made Copts uneasy, to say the least, as well as moderate Muslims. Election tensions between the government and the Brotherhood has also spilled over into violence against Christians and churches during Ramadan in November 2005 and on Palm Sunday 2006. Second, in a more recent incident just 3 weeks ago, the Ministry of Religious Endowments in Egypt published a book authored by an Islamic scholar that included injurious polemics against Christians, some of which was seen as malicious and seemed to incite and legitimize attacks against Christians. But as a result of nearly 3 weeks of vocal opposition by Copts in Egypt and the threat of suing the ministry by a Christian lawyer, the book was taken out of circulation and the author and the ministry issued public apologies. There are many books out there that attack Christians, but the fierce opposition came mainly because this book was published by a public institution, that is supported by Christian and Muslim taxpayers. Third, international incidents such as the Danish cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad and Pope Benedict's recent speech have brought about unwarranted opportunities for tension that could have and should have been avoided. In such a politically and religiously charged atmosphere in the Middle East and around the world, there are individuals and groups that are ready to pounce on half opportunities for the purpose of scoring mainly domestic political points. But the problem is that sometimes fishing for half opportunities may bring about half victories. And for many frustrated individuals in the Arab world, the dignity gained in half victories, such as the removal of Danish Christian feta cheese off the grocery store shelves, was more than their governments had produced in decades. Lastly, Iraq. should I say more, really? Christians have, for the most part, abandoned the country with no possibility of return in sight. The crushing animosity between Shiites and Sunnis in Iraq leaves them no room for their survival. Furthermore, these tensions in and around Iraq have effectively spilled over into the entire region, and their consequences can be seen, for example, in Lebanon. As if Lebanese political and confessional complexities were not enough, the Sunni-Shiite tension in Iraq has been mirrored in interconfessional strife in Lebanon, a situation which seems to be tempered only by the fact that there are Christians on both sides of the political rift in Lebanon. General Aoun is with the Shiite Hezbollah, both of them exploiting the victory during the summer, while others, smaller Christian parties, siding with Hariri's Sunni bloc, hoping to make political gains of their own. As such, the role of Christians in Lebanon can hardly be seen as a tempering factor. If anything, it's fair to say that Christian-Christian and Muslim-Muslim tensions are on the rise, and relations are very strained within and among each of these communities. So where do Arab Christians fit as far as playing a positive role in times of interfaith crises? For many people, the term Arab Christian itself continues to be an oxymoron. As you probably heard many times before, Arab Christians are Arab but not Muslims, and are Christian but not Western. This situation would not ordinarily be an issue. It was less of an issue at the height of Arab nationalism in the mid-1900s. But in times of heightened religious awareness leading to interfaith tension, such as these times, the predicament of Arab Christians comes to the fore. While Muslims in the Arab world, particularly those who live alongside significant Christian minorities, have not necessarily acted against their Christian neighbors in retaliation for Western transgressions against Islam and its holy symbols, there is little doubt that some Christian symbols have borne the brunt of what was perceived as the West's insults of Islam. In response to such tension, several interfaith dialogue organizations are well placed to contain and deal with popular backlash against Christians and the church, while at the same time providing a forum by which Christians and Muslims united can address extremist elements in Islam and Christianity in the East and West. One of such groups is the Arab Group for Christian-Muslim Dialogue. In March 2006, and in response to the Danish cartoon incident, they held a meeting where a decision was taken to draft a code of conduct that would guide the actions of members of both faiths in times of interfaith crisis. This code of conduct is currently being completed and will be presented at a workshop in March 2007. This is not the first document that the Arab Group for Christian-Muslim Dialogue has drafted. In fact, since its establishment in 1995, this group of independent scholars, historians, academicians, and activists who come from Egypt, Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, Palestine, Sudan, and the United Arab Emirates have worked tirelessly to draft what came to be known as the Arab-Muslim-Christian Covenant on Dialogue and Coexistence. For this group of interfaith dialogue activists and many of its observers, this covenant exemplified one of the most significant documents related to interfaith dialogue and cooperation between Muslims and Christians since the covenant of Umar ibn al-Khattab in the first decades of Islam, promising safety for Christians and their places of worship. It is on the basis of this 25-article covenant, which was concluded and presented in 2001, that the group has based much of its work since then. What, then, are the implications of these concerns on interfaith dialogue in the Middle East? Dialogue proponents, for years, have been working to depoliticize religion, knowing that adding religious discourse in primarily political arguments can only raise the level of tension and act as a handy demonization tool against the other. In the course of depoliticization, dialogue advocates have opted for what is called the dialogue of life, encouraging research on shared values and culture, and highlighting the common ground upon which Christians and Muslims can stand. There is certainly much common ground that has been found: human rights, democratization, justice, equal citizenship. However, most were keen on stating that we should leave the faith out of interfaith dialogue. Theology and ritual would be left aside lest it interfere with matters of life. I'd like to close my intervention today by asking the following questions. Has this approach stopped interfaith tension? A related question thus must be the following. How much of an impact have these interfaith dialogue groups, those that promote a dialogue of life, had in times of political or religious crisis? Lastly, if what we are seeing today in the Middle East are not just political conflicts shrouded in religious vocabulary, but deep, real theological conflicts, has the time come for interfaith dialogue activities to address theological differences rather than commonalities, with the hope that the dialogue of life will be further strengthened? Thank you.
Thank you, Sam, for that very helpful presentation. Our third speaker is Professor Mark Gopin. Mark holds an endowed professorship at ICAR at George Mason University, where he's also director of the Center for World Religions, Diplomacy, and Conflict Resolution. Mark is an outstanding figure in the field of religious peacemaking, as well as being an Orthodox rabbi. He's the author of three very important books on peacemaking, two of which are pathbreaking works focused on religious peacemaking in the Middle East, and we're happy to have Mark to present today.
Thank you very much, David. USIP's program that David has pioneered has been one of the most stalwart supporters of experimental approaches to interfaith relations that large numbers of institutions have failed to support. And that boldness and experimentation right in the heart of a governmental or semi-governmental agency is a very courageous step, and it's something that's been very important for the field. I don't envy the person that tried to come up with the title for today of the crisis in interfaith relations in the Middle East. I'm not sure there's a crisis. I'm not sure that it's about interfaith relations, and I'm not sure it's limited to the Middle East, whatever it is. So that presents some difficulties. I think that the crises that are probably being referred to is the evolving relationships and power struggles that are emerging in the Sunni Shiite relationship, which of course is intra-faith, not interfaith. But that massive ramifications of what's going on in Iraq and what's going on in Lebanon, and the bold introduction of those what's going on in Lebanon that then impacted what's going on in Israel and the war in the summer. All of these things involving a major increase in Iranian intentions to have a major central place in the future of Middle East relations has also created a counter response from Israel, from the Jewish community in the United States, and for increased confrontation. The question is, are these all interfaith relations, or are they actually about state struggles of a very deep nature involving complex relationships between the United States, Iran, Saudi Arabia, and of course Israel, and the constituencies in those communities? And this has dogged us since the beginning in the analysis of interfaith relations in general, is that how do you define something as an interfaith relationship as opposed to an interstate relationship with faith communities or ethnic communities as a cover, as a proxy for state influence. It's led many analysts to basically dismiss the faith or religious element of a community and simply look at them as an ethnic group that is a power group that is a proxy for state policies. And it really cannot be denied that those elements have a huge impact on the crisis, especially since the summer and the rising tensions. I'm struck more and more by the meetings that I'm in the last few weeks and months of just how much there are unstated intentions of confrontation between at least a certain portion of the Iranian leadership and the Saudi leadership that's being played out in this city, in Washington, and the complex way in which that is also involving the Jewish community, the established Jewish community, the pro-Israel lobby. Now let's get into a little bit of how that plays out in terms of religious issues and identity. I've never been thrilled about the fact that I find myself at the center of Abrahamic conflict, of the Jewish-Christian and Muslim nexus, but that's where I always end up receiving the most information. And it's impossible to deny that there's a series of actions and counteractions here between the communities that's leading to more and more of a crisis. The war on terrorism and the way it's been articulated in the last 6 years, certainly by millions of Muslims around the world, is perceived not as a war on terrorism, but as a war on Islam. And there's some good evidence for it being a war on Islam or Muslims. And then the war on Israel, or the conflict with Israel, is being perceived more and more by the Jewish community, the Jewish establishment, as a war on the Jews. And there is extensive evidence for that too, in terms of the deep rise in anti-Jewish literature and themes throughout the Muslim world, and particularly emanating from the president of Iran and the Holocaust denial gatherings of people and those kind of demonstrations. So there is this rising tension that it's hard to look at it in any deep theological way, in the same way that it would be hard to see deep theological things at work in Ireland. And yet it is involving the corporate groups of faith communities. It's involving the religious subgrouping of people called Jews and the religious subgrouping of people called Shia and Sunni and so on. So that's the state of what I think might be referred to as the crisis and how it may have to do with interfaith relations. I don't believe it's related, it's limited to the Middle East, for the simple reason that you cannot see what's going on in the Middle East or even in Sunni Shia relations without seeing the incursion of the American predominantly Protestant West that has inserted itself so deeply and so militarily into the middle of all of this, and also the action counter reaction of the way in which everybody uses their weapons in this cultural war, in the sense that the president of Iran understands the power of evoking hatred or fear of Jews, and he understands that that has an impact. And at the same time, the Jewish community knows its assets in the need to confront Iran as that's spoken, and the tension that is leading to in terms of the future of policy and the kind of things that are being dealt with in this city. Also, the nature of the occupation of Iraq. Who exactly occupied? What kind of people were in the CPA? We should do more investigation, but if the frontline, you know, report was true, there was a heavy content that involves the Abrahamic family in terms of some of the catastrophes of that occupation and the kind of young people who were running the CPA. For several years, how they were vetted in Washington and what their positions were in that particular conflict and how they performed. So I just don't think that you can limit this to the Middle East. I don't think you can limit it to just, you know, a Sunni Shia emerging conflict. It involves all elements of the Abrahamic community of Jews, Christians, and Muslims, and their impact in a complex way on state relations and the perspective of the faith communities. Now, I've spent a lot of time as an analyst in my life, but at the same time, I'm an activist, and sometimes I'm neither. It's perhaps it is now, but I've spent more time as lately as an activist than as an analyst, and I just want to share with you some of my impressions of both being in the field and also analyzing as to the state, the ambivalent state of interfaith relations, the evolving state of interfaith relations that I see, rather than the crisis. First, I'll just mention the what I'm seeing and hearing from my work in Israel and Palestine, in the sense that there continue to be the tragic limitations of interfaith relations and dialogue that I think, and certainly I've learned a great deal from Professor Abu Nimer, who's going to be up here soon, about the critique and the necessary critique of dialogue and dialogic relations. And interfaith relations or interfaith dialogue at its worst is a cover for the status quo, it's a cover for not doing anything. There's all sorts of problems and limitations to interfaith dialogue. Interfaith relations and dialogue at its best is a transformative means of catalyzing a relationship in a way that diplomacy and secular state relations fails to do. It's a way of catalyzing and highlighting the real things that need to change in the relationship at a deep level that often diplomacy and dialogue and high-level negotiations never get to. So you see in interfaith relations a real dichotomy from what it is at its best and what it is at its worst. And you see both right now in Israel-Palestine. You see on the one hand the continuing problem of interfaith programs that are highly imbalanced in the sense of who's there and who's controlling the discussion, with the dominant community dominating the discussion and dominating the character and nature of the group and the agenda. And that continues to frustrate, and that involves the limitations of the lag time between foundations and others who support this work, and their capacity to self-criticize, to shift gears. But at the same time, you also see this interesting evolution in relationships and the evolution in experimentation. So that, for example, there's I'm struck by the fact that, you know, statistically we know in Israel that, and this is true by and large with religious communities, or if you want to call them fundamentalist communities, fundamentalists are particularly poor at dialogue. It's not a strength of ritually based communities. Their strength is ritual and doing, not talking, and certainly not listening. Because, you know, if they do talk, it's about conversion or about some form. So it's not a strength of the community, and yet dialogue has always been the focus of interfaith peacemaking. And at the same time, and I always sensed that, and we wrote about that for years, and I sensed at the same time that a particular strength of these communities is care, is social justice care. And what's interesting that's evolving is that the attitudes of the religious communities continue to lag behind that centrist group in Israel-Palestine that wants peace and that says they want peace, so that the religious communities are behind that statistically. And yet, they seem to be experimenting more with cutting-edge notions of how to really change the relationship. In other words, isolated cases, interesting cases, where an ultra-Orthodox community, by the way, I don't identify as an Orthodox rabbi. I happen to have a rabbi degree, but I'm non-denominational at this point. Just a little parenthesis there. Okay.
Good to have an update.
It's an update. Yeah. We always have to update in this work. We go through our own mini crises all the time, being in the middle between many communities. An ultra-Orthodox community living next to a Palestinian community on the other side of the Green Line, and the other side, there's a community that doesn't have an ambulance. Kids are dying because they can't get one. They ask the PA, the PLO. They don't have money. They go to Hamas. Hamas doesn't have the money. They actually go to this ultra-Orthodox community, and lo and behold, the community is eager to work on raising funds for an ambulance. And suddenly there is this relationship going on between an ultra-Orthodox community and a Palestinian community on the other side of the Green Line in order to raise funds for health care. In addition, there's a chief rabbi, ultra-Orthodox, right next to a Palestinian community who reaches out to the sheikh and says, what can we do for your poor? What can we do on poverty relief? In other words, for them to sit and study and talk theology, out of the question. Talk dialogue about a future coexistence, two-state solution, neither the one of them believe in a state. Any state. But they can talk about poverty relief. And that's remarkable. They can do something about poverty relief. Will it address the imbalances? Does it look at the systemic issues of the power relations? That's something that Mohammed and I can argue and see what happens. But what's interesting is the pragmatism of it, despite the fact that the fundamentalists or the ultra-religious are seen as so otherworldly. that's just a misnomer. There are certain aspects to religious psychology that are very otherworldly, and there are others that are deeply pragmatic. And anybody who wants to understand the Muslim Brotherhood, the Ikhwan, and all these others need to understand the pragmatism of social justice and care at the root of the Islamic Revolution throughout the Middle East. So that's, there are some interesting experimentation and promising relationships that are, continue to move in Israel-Palestine. I myself have been involved for several years in a very different environment, a much more limited and difficult environment, police state of Syria. And in my experience in the last few years, unfortunately, when I first started out my work, there was a Damascus Spring, and there was authentic ferment in Damascus. There was authentic ferment of what the future of Ba'athism was. There were Ba'athists who were talking, people openly in the cafes discussing the future. I was welcomed and honored. I've always been welcomed and honored, but there was an atmosphere that things may change, things are moving. And as it became clear that the intention of this city was regime change in Syria, things started to become much, much more difficult and cold and suspicious. And at the same time, one part of the community, one part of the leadership, I believe, moving towards an openness to change, and at the same time, another part of the leadership intending to, I'm not going to say and accuse what happened in Lebanon, but just a very different approach to control and continued story of a forceful, corrupt control of Lebanon that led to some very dire consequences. And all of this came about, and things started to become very, very chilled. Nevertheless, in this very difficult atmosphere, a very liberal mufti of Syria was appointed by Assad, and he and I ended up working together. And at the same time, he used to be from Aleppo. A very jihadi-oriented mufti was appointed in Aleppo. I, of course, he didn't want to meet me, and I never met him. But we have had a remarkable experience in a mosque in Aleppo this spring, where the mufti and I could not, you know, you can't say much in public and you can't say much in private sometimes in Syria. And so we have a very deep friendship, and yet we can't talk all that easily, and he doesn't have a very good English. And he put me in the middle, he invited me to the mosque and to 50 people in a room this size where he was holding forth on a Friday. And I'm sitting here with him in this stage, and out of the blue he introduces me to a man, and a young man in white, and he's going on and he says, and this man was in Abu Ghraib. And this man was in Abu Ghraib for 9 months, and he was in a coffin for 24 days. And so I was just stunned. He didn't prepare me for it at all. And I didn't know what to do. And I got up in the middle of the mufti talking, which I've never done before. It wasn't exactly a diplomatic thing to do. And I walked over to this young man, and I started speaking to him, and I apologized to him in the name of the American people for what had been done to him. And this had a bit of an electric impact on the room, and the mufti was very moved. I think he knew me well enough that he knew I was going to behave this way, so he kind of manipulated me a little bit. But it's okay. I respect his circumstances. And then he told the gathering of 3,000 people, the larger gathering, of what had happened. And he had us again go up in front of everyone in this way. And then he had them all take out their cell phones, this is quite remarkable, and record it. Said, show the world what we can do here. And it had this impact in the next couple of days on the Syrian leadership, on Bashar Assad. And the mufti came and saw me on Sunday, and he was in a completely different mood and said that we did something here that was more important than all the speeches of the President of the United States, according to Bashar. In other words, there's a movement afoot, and there's a way in which Bashar has jihadis under his control, and he has liberals under his control. And because we demonstrated that day that there's a different way to manage the war between the United States and Syria, a different way to manage the war on Islam, if you will, it won points for a certain side of Islam in Syria, a very moderate side of Islam in Syria. So there are these struggles, even in the worst of circumstances, where people in very difficult places are struggling to take the moment of interfaith relations and make it into a vehicle of transformation. And there are things like this going on in other countries as well. It is very difficult to do. The more challenging it is to the status quo of political parties or control of governments, the more that it will evoke a counter response. And the art of finding the way to engage in interfaith relations without at the same time getting yourself killed or in jail is an interesting question for our work. It is not as direct an assault on states and difficult states as human rights work, but nevertheless it is a challenging and dangerous set of experiments that people are engaged in, very, very courageous people in a number of these countries. So I think that we're in this evolving relationship, and it's a relationship of conflict, but also a relationship, a passionate relationship. There are ways in which the aggressive intentions, there are ways in which we're reaching a point of crisis that everybody is rethinking how far we're going to take this. This clearly ferment in Iran that we're hearing every day against a very aggressive approach to the United States, to Israel, etc. And at the same time, there's a tremendous amount of deliberation even here in this city as to how far we're going to take confrontation, and especially when it involves confrontation of Jews, Muslims, and Christians as such. And I leave it as an ambivalent space where there's an evolving set of actions and counteractions, and we don't know where this is going, and we can only hope to play a constructive role ourselves in our own small ways to move the relationship in a less destructive direction and a more peaceful direction. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mark. I'm reassured to know it's not a crisis. Our final presenter is Professor Mohammed Abu Nimer. He's a professor at American University, where he, in addition to his professorship, he's director of Peace Building and Development Institute. He's also the founder and director of Salam Institute, a network of Muslim peacemakers. He's widely experienced in interfaith peacemaking, including all parts of the Middle East, as well as places like Sri Lanka and Philippines. And he's author of a book entitled Nonviolence and Peacemaking in Islam, and a new book that USIP is proud that we will be publishing this spring on interfaith dialogue in the Middle East based upon field work in Egypt, Lebanon, Jordan, and Israel, Palestine. So, Mohammed.
I am the practical guy, so I'm gonna try to answer the question that Rizek, my friend here, put for you. Do these interfaith groups, dialogue, peace groups that based on religious faith or motivation work? How do they work? So we look at their model, approach, at the processes that they use inside these workshops, and maybe at some of the pitfalls, limitations that they have. These are really the three things, and I have a 19 PowerPoint that you're not going to see them, so I'm going to work from from mine, and it's my fault, not David. I wasn't prepared enough in time to tell them to do the setup, but actually that might work better. Otherwise, it'll take 40 minutes to go through this. First, though, I think there is a crisis, so we have a bit of a The title is perfect for me. There is a crisis, and you know, it's very hard not to notice Afghanistan, Iraq, Palestine, and Lebanon at least. And looking at the relationship in these four areas in the last 4 or 5 years, definitely there is a crisis, if not an ongoing war in Israel-Palestine that has not been recognized as such, but I think there is definitely room for that. Let me first start with the notion of the first question we usually deal with this field, is the conflict religious or political? And we spend, at least in our classes, at least one session debating that, and at the end I say it's not really political, it's not religious, it's both of them. And Israel-Palestine is a master case how Palestinian Muslim and the Jews especially have historically manipulated their faith and their religious identity to justify political violence as well as escalation of this conflict. The Zionist movement as a political as well as a national movement in the pre-1948 as well after have done a masterful job in taking the Judaic faith and integrating it or manipulating it in a way to both formulate a national identity as well as negate the other identity. The Islamic also activists in 1930s from Al-Qassam and later on to many other religious groups have masterfully provoked the religious identity, Islamic identity, in order to justify certain violence and certain escalation. So even if the conflict is not religious, religion has been significant enough of a factor that we have to address it, and my colleague Mark definitely put the sort of his manuscript, the first one, told all of us that religion is enough of a factor need to be included rather than excluded from Oslo, from Camp David 1, Camp David 2, or from any other political agreement. And indeed, it's very hard to look at an Oslo agreement that deals with the Holy Land, but none of the holy people are involved in the negotiation process. Basically, it was done by atheist, secularist, Palestinian, as well as Israelis. So it's hard to market a product done by atheist or religious community, especially if it deals with Al-Aqsa or the Wailing Wall or Jerusalem in general. So I think that case has been settled, especially by Mark's work, at least in this field. Hopefully the politicians will listen at some point to this recommendation that religion do matter, or religions do matter in this area. My main really points for today are based on interviews in Lebanon, Egypt, Israel, Palestine, as well as Jordan. We interviewed at least 30 to 40 people who work on religion and peace in this area. And in some areas, this is really the whole universe in that sense. We managed to capture 90% of the people who work in this area because the population who work in this area are very, very small. So in that sense, you know, we have a good response from these people. We ask them about their work, how they perceive it, how they conceptualize it, and what type of assumption they have, what type of success story they can share with us. And that's what we actually will be reported. One of the primary questions actually we dealt with is if religion do matter, what type of religious role religious people could do in this context. And of course they can educate for peace, they can contribute to social justice and economic development. They also could put some actual input in the negotiation and even in monitoring agreement like in Mindanao, Philippines, where religious, Catholic and Muslim have formed the grassroots monitoring committees on the ground and were actually acknowledged by the Malaysian as well Indonesian third party intervener there, and they found their role capacity in the negotiation. They also, religious groups could work for advocacy, for justice, to be more on the active action side. So there are plenty of room for the religious activists to contribute, deal with the conflict. Our colleague and the practitioner in this field in these five countries did not really see this picture very clearly. Their work has been mostly, I can classify it, into three models. three approaches. The first approach I came to call the harmony model, where we look at things that generate a good feeling, more ceremonial, ritual, Muslim, Christian, Jews, or Druze, in most cases, in these four countries or five countries, come together in a gathering like this. They do their opening prayer. They do some, of course, you have to have hummus, falafel, and food sometimes, and the drink, and the cultural event, and at the end you do your closing prayer. Very important as a humanizing act, and it does establish relationship. Yet, if you do that every time for the entire year with different cultural program, it, you know, it really drives some people to ask the question, why we're doing this? So, back as Rizik, I think, mentioned to you, it's apolitical, it's depoliticized. It's apolitical, it's mostly ritualistic, and this notion, especially in Israel, Palestine, have came, especially in the Jewish side, and I think this is an American culture impact, especially West Coast type of spirituality, where you have individualistic approach to spirituality. Kind of people who came up with their own religion or their own faith dimension, and they come to these groups, and you see them there circulating with some, for the local, very strange dancing on a chanting. But they all call it, I participated in three of those in the Galilee at least, and it was very strange to do, sort of to engage what they call zikr at that time as a Sufi practice, which I don't think many Sufi will ascribe to that, definitely not from Turkey or other parts of the Muslim world. Nevertheless, that was valid enough for them to be an interfaith group. The most feature in the harmony model is similarities. We connect with each other in the most comfortable zone area that we would like. Therefore, we do all the activities in order not to deal with theological differences or deal with political differences. So that's why I sort of called it the harmony model, because they're really interested in this aspect. The second model or the second approach is number of a group that I think Rizik mentioned them at even the same term I've used also in Dialogue of Life, where what they did in SEOS, I did a major evaluation for SEOS in Egypt, and they've adopted this model. They go to a Upper Egypt poor village, and they identify agricultural problem, and they bring Muslim and the Christian from the same village or neighboring villages, and they will work on this agricultural issue. But the fact that they're Muslim and they're Christian is not really a big issue. The issue is the poverty reduction or that specific project. Sometimes the issue of faith comes up, but they told me very clearly in Aswan in March last year, we don't talk about religion. And when I played the devil advocate in a conference, I was actually hushed by the organizer. You're setting some problems for us. We have agreed not to deal with religion because religion is for God, and that's not our domain. And these are clergy, these are priests and imam in Egyptian context. But I think it's very important. In some cases, this is the only way how you can gain entry and also work. And that's the way you're really connected to the local community you're working with, through these things that matter to people. And what matters to people at the end of the day, if there is a road that's paved, if there is school that's open, if there's a library that's there, if there's an agriculture or microfinance project. Within the Dialogue of Life, there's also a sub-approach that has to say, which I think is newly introduced, we bring them together and we give them a training in conflict resolution or mediation or peace or problem solving, which I think is a skill-oriented. We educate them, we give them communication, you know, so you find the priest and the imam in Egypt doing, you know, what anybody do, communication skill exercise. Do you hear me? Do you see? You teach paraphrasing. And you do all the good communication exercise we do with anyone who study mediation and conflict resolution. For what matter is not clear. Would it result in actual projects, concrete tasks? It's not clear. Most of these projects don't really continue. So they end up frustrated with the skills itself and with the training, but no actual part, application to it. The third approach, again, but this is, I think, the second or the least existing in that sense, has to do I call it liberation approach, liberation model. And here you find people who have taken their religious differences, confronted them, explored some similarities also, but we're more concerned how can we as a group, as individual also, confront injustices, confront political system and the structure that is continuously producing our conflict. And they actually take some actions, rabbis for human rights, even if it's a Jewish Israeli organization, were courageous enough during the Intifada to go to some villages and stand in front of the Israeli army and remove some of the dirt from the villages were sieged, and they will go for an entrance of the village and try to remove the dirt. The Israeli army will come after 2 hours and put sort of the dirt back, but it doesn't matter. Symbolically, when the local villagers saw them, they brought them coffee and some food, and they stood there, did not help them, but they stood there, look at them in an act of solidarity, and they left. Or the Rabbi for Human Rights doing campaign to help people actually harvest their olive in the olive trees sort of season, that to pick up, to allow the Palestinian villages to have access there. Sabil conference doing some action regarding solidarity with the Palestinian and also toward the peace movement, and meeting with some Israelis. These are two examples where you find some action, social justice. Also, we did a conference for nonviolent resistance in Bethlehem about a year and a half ago. I think Lee was there also, and there were some also people with a strong faith coming out and doing some march for nonviolence. And in the weekend, went to Balayin, a Palestinian village that was resisting the construction of the wall. And those religious activists went there and they stood in front of the Israeli army in order to protest and resist the occupation. This is totally different project or different model. I see it more actually in Philippines and Sri Lanka. I just came back from Sri Lanka on Wednesday after evaluating about 500 different grants given by the USAID to different peace groups, and this model was very clear among many of the Buddhist as well Hindu and Muslim and the Christian activists in this area. In Israel, Palestine, and also in the Arab world, in Lebanon, Egypt, we don't have that model fully in place, and even there is a bit problem with it. Understandably enough, in Egypt, I was doing a training, and then you find at the end of the room a security service person, and everybody knows. In the middle of the training, they sort of give me a note, you know, be careful, which means, you know, the person is in. When he's in, then you have to watch what you will talk. So really, the bar or the limit is very different. In Lebanon, again, with the explosive situation right now, any confrontation of that sort can be very costly to people. Regardless, most of these groups in the Arab countries have been within the harmony model and moving a little slowly into the dialogue of life model. Just let me move in the last few minutes into the processes. What type of processes you have? And here we have to go into the room like this and observe people and see how do they talk to each other. Are they really transforming like Mark Goffin apology in the Aleppo, right?
Aleppo.
Halab, yes. The very courageous act, you know, an act of apology publicly, we should have very, very much sort of, this is the type of liberation theology you want to see in some of these aspects. But to do that, you have to do already lots of work in your ethnocentric, religious-centric, meaning that you're not only seeing your faith is the only faith, but you made room for the Christian, for the Muslim, for the Jew in the space of the other that you had. To do that, you have to use the process of pluralism or pluralist religious approach. Many of the participants I've met, they still struggle with their religious-centric. They still, again, they're not here to convert each other because Christian, Muslim, Jews in Israel, Palestine, and in most of the region have already decided many centuries ago, no more conversion. It's just those evangelicals who come from across the ocean who don't know that rule yet. But, you know, locally they knew that they're not going to convert each other anymore, so it's best to coexist. What does coexistence mean in most of these communities? And I think that's where the root of the problem is. Coexistence meant we live side by side. You do not ask me about my faith. I don't ask you about your faith, but it's tolerance. It is coexistence. And I don't tell my children about your faith. It's kind of very strict boundary drawing. So when there is a crisis, we're not sure, in case of violence, that I can hold all the Muslim not to attack the Christian, because not to attack somebody means you have to know them as the other intimately. You have to know their values to appreciate that. You have to have the space. Many of the interfaith dialoguers that we spoke to have not done that process, so we've called them more religio-centric dialogue in that sense. I'm here to tell you what the Prophet Muhammad said about Abraham, but I'm not really here to listen totally and to make a space to the Trinity issue, because I know that's not accurate or true or doesn't fit with my belief system. So I don't make a space for it. We here really to discover similarities, because it's harmony. Another process we hear for non-political, because it's dangerous to talk about politics all the way around. Therefore, we avoid it. And the other process, we're here for education awareness, and we're not here for action. But if you look at all of these four continuum, as four dimension as continuum, you could see some mix of these. But in general, the interfaith dialogue was religious-centric, look for similarities more in the harmony and more educational, cognitive, rather than action-oriented. Some of the pitfalls, the difficulty that they have. You know, actually I should be more positive, so I'll give you three things that they really do well. I saw a picture yesterday, actually, sent to me several pictures from Interfaith, and the settler, one of our colleagues, hugging a Muslim from Hebron. This is a settler from Tikwa, giving a hug in a Jewish wedding in the settlement with somebody he met with in an interfaith dialogue. That's very humanizing for the Muslim and for the Jew to dance in a wedding, despite the fact that each one of them belong to different community, and one from the settler and one from the from Hebron, the neighbor in there. So they rehumanize each other, and also they learn a little bit about each other, information cognitively. There are some aspects that they learn. A third component that I've sort of noticed is this notion that I think Rizik spoke about, is they spread a message of peace and tolerance. Meaning it's not anymore, if you want to use the, it's not cool to attack the other. Or it's not appropriate. It's really social stigma for certain circles, especially middle upper class, Muslim, Christian. They don't engage in that. So there is a message of peace that's been spreading. Some attribute to reduction of violence. In Muharram Beg event in Egypt, when a Christian group put or was planning to put a play about the Prophet Muhammad, and it was spread outside, lots of people came to attack the church. The Egyptian army or security protected the church, and the people who mediated the case were pretty much Alexandria Interfaith Dialogue Group. They appeared in front of the local parliament or local government, testifying about why we should not be engaging in religious violence or this type of escalation. So there are lots of cases if you want to look for positive, successful story. Nevertheless, I'll give you one pitfall, one limitation from each of these aspects. In one limitation, the representation, who participate in these events. Mostly, as I said, upper middle class, educated, even sometimes Western educated individual, and in general have a weak link to the community. So they tend to be those a civil society group with very weak link to the community. When there is, and this is dangerous because when there is a need for mobilization, the community is not connecting to them, and they keep to circulate within the same 100 famous interfaith dialoguer in that town or in that city. The second issue is sustainability. When there is a violence, like in Israel-Palestine, the Intifada starts in 2000, many of them will collapse. They don't really sustain themselves. Programmatically, underfunded, many of them don't have any facilitation or skills, so really learn by trial, trial and error. Most of them lack that. They have asymmetric power relations. The Muslim in Egypt dominate the dialogue agenda. The Jews in Israel, Israeli Jews, dominate the dialogue agenda. The Christian and Muslim in Jordan have decided very clearly, we have no conflict.
We did about 25 interviews. No single one will talk about a conflict. And because there is no conflict in Jordan, this Jordan, what it does, it produces interfaith dialogue message to the outside world, but not internally. That was the primary objective of most of the interfaith dialogue, really to show how wonderful the model of dialogue and interfaith relation in Jordan. And that's why we've been carrying these events since 1984. Significant, I think, in many ways, the seminars, but no internal look at it. Localized interfaith model. Most of the model are used is imported from Europe, US, and other training. There is no organically grown model for interfaith dialogue in this part. Let me finish by saying that as a field, it's really, as Mark said, it's evolving. It's growing. There are lots of potential for its influence and impact if it is treated as in a strategic way, serious and professional, rather than symbolic, ceremonial, and haphazard kind of events or training events or organization. And also, the last point here, it's evolving, but in a disconnect from many social movements in these countries. In Israel, Palestine, there is a strong peace movement or peace groups. In Lebanon, in Egypt, in Jordan, there are a human rights group. There are political opposition group who seeking change, similar objective of change. Those interfaith dialogue have not connected to this movement. What do they need? Really more support and more encouragement in the sense of the, as a field to grow and move, be, or to be more effective. Thank you.
Thank you, Mohammed. As always, very stimulating and illuminating. We're going to take questions from the audience, and if you have a point or question, you can line up behind one of either of these two microphones. But just before we start, do any of the panelists have any very brief comments or questions you want to address to each other? Ben?
Yes, actually, if I may. I was very interested in, first of all, the fact that nobody mentioned Muslim-Christian relations amongst Palestinians, because I think we've today just looked at Palestinian-Israeli relations, but I think a very interesting topic would be the Christian-Muslim relations within Palestine. The other thing I was interested in is that nobody sort of linked all of this to the crisis, and I think there is a rising crisis or rising tensions. None of the speakers linked it to the growth in the politicization of religion, and particularly the politicization of Islam over the last 20 years, really. What role does that play? I would have liked some of the panelists, my fellow panelists, I should say, to talk about this. Thank you.
On the left here, do you want to identify yourself and pose your question?
Yes, my name is Steve Sawmill. A question that I'll ask in a moment about the Shia Sunni relationship and the situation in Iraq. But first, just to mention that by way of background of my question, the Bush administration says that the plan they're now pursuing is the Maliki plan, whereas the November 30th meeting that Maliki had with Bush, what he put on the table was that there would be no more troops and that that the U.S. troops would withdraw to the outskirts of Baghdad. Now the surge is more troops and within Baghdad and embedding. Please bear that in mind with my question. And the second part to bear in mind is that now Senators Warner, Collins, Coleman now have their resolution in addition to Biden's form of resolution against the surge. And Warner feels that the U.S. troops
should withdraw. I think we know a lot
that they should withdraw from Baghdad, which is very similar to what Maliki wanted. So my question is, number one, do you think that Maliki can be trusted by the U.S. to do his commitments in terms of, one, his intent, and secondly, his ability? And what do you think of the idea of the U.S. troops withdrawing to the outskirts of Baghdad?
I think we'll take several questions and then have the responses. Yes?
Colonel Datta, President of Indian Veteran Officers Association and a member of Foreign Policy Association. I have a slightly different with historical connotations question. Islam came to India, and the erstwhile India before 1947 was faced with a dilemma that Muslims are a different nation, it is a different social order. Hence Pakistan was made. But the emergence of Bangladesh blew up this two-nation theory, and the very Pakistan was broken up in two. Bringing down to Iraq, or in Middle East in general, the dialogues between the Sunnis and Shias has failed. No matter how much it has been tried to bring about a kind of peace, though Islam means peace. But it is ironical that the pursuants of terrorism, almost all terrorists are Muslims, even in the sectarian war. Is terrorism is the bridge between the two?
My name is Ahmed Al-Qadri Salman. I'm a business consultant. I come from the Middle East, of course, and specifically from Egypt. And I have certain remarks about what the panel have said. First one is, if we talk about Egypt and we go back through history to 1919, where Christians and Muslims and Jews were one unit, to the point that they had a flag of their own which had the crescent and the cross, and they intermingled. And still they do that. I mean, my best friends, one of my best neighbors was Jewish, best friends are Christians. There is no problem between them. Then if we talk about Iraq, and we read in the newspapers that there were a lot of intermarriages before this era, and people coexisting in the same neighborhood. What changed all this? Is it just a power struggle, or there is a kind of force that we do not know about that is moving all those things? And what can we do about it? Why can't we go back to what we were before?
Thank you. Yes.
Ibrahim Siddiqui, Voice of America Television. The Prime Minister of India, Rajiv Gandhi, I think he was, if I'm correct, I think he was assassinated by a Tamil terrorist. So the assumption that all terrorists are Muslims, I would like you to comment on that. And if Rajiv Gandhi was killed by a Tamil tiger, assassin terrorist, how do you communicate to a terrorist? How do you talk to somebody who wants to blow you up? Or is there a need for dialogue? Should you just pick up a gun and try to kill them? Or is there a way to actually sit down and talk to these guys? Be it Tamil tigers, be it somebody from Mossad, be it somebody from a Muslim sect, whatever. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take one more and then we'll give the panelists a chance to respond.
My name is John Prim, and I have something similar to following that. This is all very feel-good. This is all very interfaith dialogue. Rabbi, I don't know how you can think there's not a crisis, but how do you deal with someone to whom the world is black and white, to whom this is a waste of time in here? This, you know, the point is, the rabbis for peace stand in front of the Israeli army and protect the Palestinians, just like Gandhi did in front of the Brits. Gandhi did that to the Brits because he knew that the British army would react to public concern in Britain. The rabbis can do that to the Israeli army because they know that it won't happen, nothing bad will happen. Do you think for one moment that a jihadist is going to go, yeah, you got a point, Muhammad, I'm sorry, I'm not going to do that. The world is black and white to many people of all religions. Now, in other religions, not all terrorists are Muslims, that's correct, but other religions to a great extent have gotten rid of, they have taken care of their fanatics in various things. There are still those in Christianity and Judaism, that's true. But when you have a very powerful, very well-connected, very wealthy group of people that say everything that's going on in this room is worthless.
And you're not Muslim, or are you saying these are Muslim?
I'm talking about Wahhabis, Salafists, so forth. Extremely powerful, very well-funded. What do you in your interfaith dialogue say to somebody who says, I could care less, and I'm going to kill you, because you're wrong, you know?
Okay. Ren, do you want to start and address any or all of the questions, and then we'll go down the line?
Yeah, I think that we need to be very honest in addressing these issues and recognize that there are groups of people for whom dialogue is irrelevant, unnecessary. And I'm not saying the dialogue is unnecessary, by the way, but I think I agree with the sentiment presented by the last questioner and a few others, that certainly there are groups who feel that they are designated by God to guide nations, and that they have the answers, and that violence and force are legitimate and necessary. And I think unless we recognize that fact, I don't think we can move forward in any kind of interfaith dialogue. Moving in with a kind of Pollyannish attitude is not going to help us. That's one thing. And I think it is the increase in the number and size and the strength of those groups over the last few decades which has at least contributed to this crisis, which I believe does exist. And I think we need to be honest about that as well. Okay. Somebody mentioned that the dialogue between the Sunni and Shia has failed. I don't think it has even started. Certainly in Iraq it hasn't started. We need to start it immediately. I will very quickly say that although I don't want to sort of go into Maliki and so on, because this is not a panel about that, but I think that there are many, many reasons why the Iraqi government is hobbled, even in areas where it wants to do the right thing. And I don't think I should say just the Iraqi government is hobbled, but the Iraqi state. A lot of the problems, a lot of the incapacity to move forward lies within that central problem that I indicated when I spoke, which is the fact that the state is structured, the architecture of the state is built on sectarian and ethnic lines, and that the entire state is now works on the system of proportionality, so that you know, everything throughout the state works on Shia proportion, Sunni proportion, Kurdish proportion, and the Prime Minister certainly finds himself extremely constrained by this. To give you a very simple example, the Prime Minister cannot fire any of his ministers. You have seen that the Prime Minister cannot order troops into a particular area of trouble because other political parties will object. So the whole way that the system is structured in Iraq right now, I think, is leads to deadlock and to paralysis. So this is, I think, the issue in Iraq.
I have just a couple of comments.
Could you pull the microphone up to you?
Yes. Just a couple of comments, one about Egypt and the other about how do you talk to terrorists. The first about Egypt, if you recall, before 1919, a couple of decades before that, and perhaps up until the 50s, that was called the liberal era in Egypt. This was the time where civil society was working strong, where there were many parties that still were relevant to politics, and at the same time, this was the time that there was even a Coptic prime minister. Where did all that go, and why are people looking back at that era and saying, you know, why aren't we doing this again? I think it has a lot to do with politics. Instead of national unity, the slogan of 1919, Egypt became dominated by successive strong-arm politics, not necessarily because of what was happening in Egypt only, but also because of what was happening in the region and internationally. So everyone in Egypt, aside from the government and those who ruled, was equally oppressed, whether it was Christian minority or whether it was the relatively moderate, at that point, Muslim Brotherhood. And that continued to be the case until the Sadat era, and then you know what happened then with the Copts and with the Muslim Brotherhood and with other Muslim groups, which were effectively used for political gains. And that was a Pandora's box that opened and wasn't shut until sometime in the mid-90s or leading up to 2000. Where did all that go? I think it just was drained out under the slogans of, I don't remember Nasser's slogan at this point, but it was more about not ad-din Allah wal watan al-jami'. Another slogan. It all eventually drained out. Religious politics is coming back strong now in Egypt because of a hint of democracy that allowed the Muslim Brotherhood, who had been working tirelessly at the grassroots level through clinics and schools and charities, to become very popular. The Copts had not done any better over the past 30 or 40 years because in response to irrelevance and violence, they cocooned, they shriveled, and they stayed in their churches. And instead of looking towards being part of the national fabric, they decided, or they were told, or they were convinced that don't worry about the hardship here at this point in Egypt, you know, just think about the afterlife, things will be great then. So don't worry about politics, just worry about religion, stay in church, the church will provide you with everything you need. And that's where we are now. Almost everyone, politically speaking now, is irrelevant, aside from the government and perhaps the Muslim Brotherhood. How does one to talk to extremists? I find that it is not my responsibility as a Christian working in interfaith dialogue to talk to an extremist Muslim. I find that Muslims who are part of interfaith dialogue groups are better suited to talk to their Muslim counterparts because they will never listen to me. And I would suppose, for instance, with Professor Gopin's experience in Damascus, he is talking to the moderate, who at that point is the Grand Mufti in Damascus. It is the responsibility of the Grand Mufti in Damascus to speak to other extremists, because they will never listen to a rabbi. They may think it's interesting that he's in Damascus, but at that point, if Muslims don't talk to Muslims, and if Christians don't talk to Christians, I think we're at a point where we can't go forward.
Okay. It's from my experience that, well, there's so much to respond to. I'll just try to be brief. In our field, we have a lot of research has been confirmed on the need to demonize, the need to discover the enemy in order to discover the self. And to think that there are people out there who think in black and white and therefore there's nothing to say to them is not to acknowledge that we think in black and white terms as well. That there are people who engage in policies around the world and policies right in this city that also involve a black and white construct of the universe. The fact is that consistently I have found every time I did think in black and white about somebody that I shouldn't be talking to, it turns out 2 years later that I made a mistake and I should have been talking to them. Now, the idea that talking is in place of military defense is simply a distortion of the my position.
What you do, you have to study Sun Tzu's Art of War. You have to understand the concepts of dividing and conquering, but you have to think of divide and conquer in nonviolent terms. Because in every group in the world, whether it be Ba'athists in Syria, or what you call Wahhabis, or what you call Salafis, or what you call Zionists, there is a right and there's a left, and there are people struggling with the future of their identity. And everybody's interacting with everyone. So everything that you do and make a move in one direction, you confuse people. And we know in our field that confusion is the basis of social change. Confusion is the basis of making it more difficult for people to divide the world in black and white and try to kill the black side. So when I went to, I had no idea where the Mufti stood when I engaged him. I certainly don't share the Mufti's point of view of when the world was created 5,000 years ago. I realized that one mistake I made in the conversation. And yet he is an extreme progressive on women's issues, on many issues, and on peace. The fact is he was then attacked by bringing me to the mosque. The way that fundamentalists do, he was attacked for months afterwards that I led the service in the mosque, because that's the way they could delegitimate him, right? But the fact is, I also should have gone to visit people to the right of him, and I would if I had more time and funding in the Middle East, because consistently I find when I don't do that, when I make a red line, I lose the opportunity to engage somebody who I thought was not engageable. It's the same with people in this country who I was afraid to talk to because somebody blacklisted them, and they turned out to have, you know, Salafist tendency. They do believe in a Sharia state, and at the same time, utterly nonviolent. And when I engaged them later on in East Jerusalem, I realized they were vilified in this country by people who wanted to blacklist a Muslim. Okay? So I find that consistently this process of reaching out is not in place of defense. It's not in place of police actions globally to protect ourselves from people who will do us harm. It is a process of engaging the world in such a way as to create a larger and larger middle, a coalition, if you will, of people committed to peace and coexistence. And some of those people are going to be fundamentalists with a view of the world that's totally different than mine, but also want coexistence. And they will even change based on my reaching out to them. I've consistently, you know, for 2 years I wasn't talking to the Saudis. And then I discovered time and again that I was making a mistake. I was generalizing it about an entire country and not seeing the possibilities within that community. It was the same consistently with every single group I've engaged. That leads me to a little bit of a plug. Oh, one last thing. I'm sorry that I said that there's no crisis. You see, I've been in a crisis ever since the first Intifada in the 1980s, so I'm so used to it, I actually feel vindicated by things catching up and by the consequences of the lack of resolution of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict on this entire region. So I'm not in crisis right now like everyone else because I've been in it. And I don't feel it as a crisis. I feel it as an evolution of learning. That's going on. I know that sounds strange, but that's just where I am. Finally, the harmony model. One intellectual disagreement. I find that a lot of the people with the harmony model in public are secretly doing the most bold activity in relationship building across enemy lines. Particularly those... So I want to make a case for the California dickers that are going on in the gallery, because I know for a fact that some of those people are reaching out at the same time to Kahanists on one side and to Hamas on the other. That's interesting to me. And it's the same with the people embracing nice hug in Hebron. Turns out they created a ceasefire at the height of the Intifada in Hebron between people in Tekoa and Hebron talking with each other through each other's military forces. That's interesting to me. And we know we're talking about the same people.
Yes.
So I just, this harmony thing is very interesting. It's a public, harmonious thing. And I'm very interested in the relationships and whether those relationships can actually lead to transformative moments, to cooperation, to resistance against injustice.
Let me take it from there.
Yes, okay. Go ahead.
This transformative relationship individualized, good and nice, and could be strategically, if it played strategically, effective. I'm worried about the harmony model being a factor in delegitimizing any grassroots involvement with these groups.
in Tiberias, in the lake in the Galilee, when I stood there with 5-6 of my colleagues as observers, they literally laughed. I said, what crazy things are these? We can't bring these people. In fact, that's why it took place in a isolated host resort area in Tiberias and not in the village where it's supposed to be, because the host did not trust that the people in the village can relate to California style vicar. It's a tough one to say.
California style vicar?
Vicar.
I know what you mean.
California style vicar.
Oh, yes. Amazing. But I think
you should explain that word. Translated.
It's a Sufi dance.
Zikr is one of the Sufi traditions. Remember, we're chanting of in the name of God.
Ritual
God is
chanting.
Great, and it's supposed to take you into a spiritual mode. But again, there are plenty of other more better articulated explanation of that. But the one I saw was not connected to the people in that community. So, that's the issue with the harmony. With the public and the private, I do agree. Many individuals, including yourself, have been doing backdoor diplomacy with key strategic intervention. That's understandable. Yet, if we talk about movement, social movement, peace movement, becoming mass enough to influence the policy, we have an issue of depoliticizing these groups to the level of apolitical and become not really relevant. I'm amazed that you can stand here in Washington and still say all Muslims are terrorists or all terrorists are Muslim. That's really beyond me. I mean, this is. I could do the same. I work in Sri Lanka, so I work with Tamil terrorists. I work in Philippines with a Christian paramilitary terrorist. I work with in good.
Almost all.
I'm really stunned by such a generalization, because most of our work comes to strike exactly on this issue of generalization, and Mark used the classic term, demonizing the other. Mm-hmm. When you stand and say, tell us in Washington, in the left side, that was from the right, this came from the left. The left side says that black and white thinking, this is the city of a black and white thinking for the last 8 years. This is the city that divided the world, evil and good, right? Or, you know, the axis of evil. So all of this is this culture, actually, where we are, invented the black and white race segregation. So it's very hard to continue with this black and white, and our work is really to look at the gray. Because the gray is where the most of the Muslim, Christian, Jews, Hindu, Buddhist. What happened, those who think black and white are managing to kidnap the middle. And our job has been really to work with the middle, not necessarily with the terrorists, because they don't recognize us as a human, as individuals, so it's hard for us to do that. Our best shot at reaching to the terrorist, or to those black and white thinking in that sense, radical, is really to do interfaith dialogue, to have the Muslim and the Christian. I really count on this guy beside me to speak to settlers. He can do that. He has a rabbi, he has a credential, he has the trouble doing that. But still, he can do that much better than me. Better than me. So that model, and by the way, that model really came from all the 5 countries. They said, we need more interfaith conversation. And I think that's something we haven't done a lot. So the Shia and Sunni is a prime example for something that needs to start yesterday, even in the 4th century needed to start. The 3rd century of Islam in that sense. But it's never late, really. So we can start with this interfaith as mechanism to bring those who think black and white, or at least marginalize them enough that they don't have, in the security terminology, ammunition. Finally, this notion of I've worked also in Egypt, and in most countries I work with, they always, even in my village, they said, we wish we go back to that 40, 30 years ago, we're brothers, and this sort of idealized notion. And it was simpler, much sort of harmonious relationship. But meanwhile, we have 2 factors. One that Rizik identified, the failure of the state system to provide to the minority and the majority political outlet. So when the system political doesn't work, groups need to voice their faith. But the second thing that we all
sort of ignore it, except I think Mark spoke about it a little bit. There is a war against, at least that's how it feels outside of Washington, war against Islam as a religion and as a people, as a culture. It feels that way from the other side. Since 1978, there is a foreign intervention, post-colonial intervention, and that external factor and the failure of the state is the primary feeders into why in most of these countries you have such level of politicized religion. And I think we have to address both of them. Even if we build Egypt as a state system, that's still not going to neutralize the war in terrorism. The same thing in my view for Iraq. Muslim and Palestinians, Christian and Muslim in Palestine, need lots of work, and there is at least two projects started to do this intra-faith work. Under occupation of the Israeli occupation, all of them said, like many of the Arab countries, by the way, all the models in the Arab countries adopted a national unity slogan. We all Arabs, and we are unified under that national identity, and this is really the best we should do in focusing on that national unity rather than on our differences. And the Muslim and the Christian in Palestine struggle with that at the same time. We are all Palestinian, and until the occupation is removed, let's not dig more deeper in our differences. And the same trick in Lebanon and Egypt and other area for many of these activists.
Thank you. Let me just make one comment in anticipation of a new publication. In response to the questions about how to approach extremists and understand them, we went to Renee Garfinkel, who is here today, and asked her to do a special report on the question of when religious extremists become peacemakers, and to take cases of Christians, Muslims, and Jews, all of whom had engaged in violence in the name of their particular faith, but then became peacemakers, and to try to understand a bit about their life stories and their transformation and any lessons we might learn from that. And that'll be published in another month or 6 weeks, so something to look forward to. Thank you very much for joining us today, and particularly thank our panelists for their stimulating presentation.
I'm particularly saddened by that because something that I would like